On this program, excerpts from the second annual AFN Youth Conference. Welcome to Potlatch. I'm Mo Osley. Ted Mala, the first Eskimo male doctor in Alaska, spoke about Native leadership, education, and the future.
I think our future will come out of this room. I think that we must learn from the examples we find around us. I find in the hospital a great man, as I was beginning to mention, and well respected by his tribe, looked to, up to by his people, and hit his home, he was fine. But all of a sudden, for one reason or another, he found himself in the city. And what happened in the city? He didn't know how to cope with all the things that happened. And he began to drink. He drank because he couldn't face all the new problems. He could face hunger, he could face the cold, he could face getting lost, he could face death, but he could not face the city. So we have one area of thought we have to consider is the native in the city, the native with progress. I think in Kotzebue we have a few less problems that are in Anchorage or in Fairbanks because there's no road. You have to fly in. You have to take the boat in when the sound isn't frozen. So in some ways we haven't been polluted. But in other ways, I think it's going to start, because all of a sudden, now we have televisions, now we have telephone, and we've always had radio. So all of a sudden, you'll get new standards coming through the television, saying, well, look at this car, look at this girl, she comes with this tire. Okay, it sounds funny, but to a person without education, education helps you see through everything and sort out the garbage from the truth. Our family never needed a television, and now everyone has a television. So now with the television, they're seeing ads for things that they don't need. But the people are saying on television, you need this. You can't live without this. And they begin to believe it. I find myself now at the medical center, and I see people that are saying, well, we need a leader. We'd like you to come out right now. We can't wait. And yet I tell them, you have to. Because one of the problems and why we're criticized so much is because a lot of people would like us to fail. A lot of people would be very happy if we just gave up and said, well, we can't do it. We don't have the genes. They would like our corporations to go under. And they would like to come in and say, I told you so. A lot of people are fantastic leaders that are leading right now. But a lot of them were pushed. I've seen great people. People with insight, people with wisdom, people with gut feeling, that were pushed into administration and were burned out. And part of it was being ready. And so I get the being a person that's just about ready just by accident. I just happened to be born at the right time and happened to go to the right school and happened to be out of school right now. I never planned to be the first male Eskimo doctor. I was surprised when I found out. And so I think our future is in your hands. I think whether we go, whether we succeed as a people, whether we prepare our people, whether we're going to survive and no longer as hunters, but with what is in our minds, whether we cope with what's going on, will depend on you, our pride, and our old people. You think about our old people. They rely on us too. They have mental resources, but physically they aren't strong. And so you're kind of the hunters of today. You still have to kind of go out, and you have to get the education to come back and to feed your people and to support them and to get them through a new era that's not survival on a physical level, but survival on a mental level.
On this road that I'm on, I don't know where life will lead. So I'll leave it and go and find my place in the sun must run to where my cup waits for me just to see. On this road that I'm on, I'm a loser, never win a race. I can't leave this place not knowing the taste of the things that life can hold, both for you and for me. All my life I've been a dreamer, never knowing how to see that a chance waits for me. So I'll go and find my place in this strange tapestry. I must go where life will lead me, right or wrong, I must, you see. Cause this way every day
Glenn Campbell. Our next segment features Elaine Ramis, Vice President for Rural Educational Affairs with the University of Alaska. She talked about new directions in education and gave some background in the fight for equality in education.
What is it like to lead a battle for better education for the future of your children and for your children when you don't even have a rights of a citizenship? When you don't have any rights at all. It is difficult for us to look back in those days and to really see the odds they were up against, but they didn't give up. They had to continue so that they paved the way. If it was not for them, you and I would not be sitting here today. The other thing that we need to really remember is if it wasn't for Alaska land claims, nobody would even have respect for us. We are now the largest commodity in Alaska. We are worth millions of dollars to the state, and not only to the state, but to the nation and international. Are we going to be able to live up to that? Are we going to be able to survive in those kinds of conditions? Your grandparents, your mothers had a lot of odds against them. You have a bigger one, I think. We talked about new directions in education. That only came about starting way back there in 1930. It really began to come to a focus in 1968. In 1968, when the Mount Edgecombe Boarding School was in question, many of your leaders today are graduates of Mount Edgecombe. And in 1968, the question was, are we going to let Mount Edgecombe, a native boarding school, continue to expand, or do we bring education to the local areas? For months, they fought that question. They are still questioning it. Where do you give the best education? Do you take the kids out of their homes at age 14 to go to high school in Mount Edgecombe and Chemawa? Do you bring them to boarding homes in Anchorage and in Fairbanks? Or is the best education to bring it to them at home? I questioned the Anchorage and the Fairbanks people, the Juneau people. Would they part with their 14-year-old girl or their 14-year-old boy to send them thousands of miles away so that they can continue their education? That is why we now have 21 rural education affairs attendance areas. We have 21 school districts so that we can bring education closer to home. Who has leadership role in your villages? How many of them are capable of the responsibilities that have been set upon them in your community? You at 18 or 19 or 20, you too are already torn apart. You're torn in two. Should I stay home and help my village, or should I continue my education? When we take you out of your villages, out of your communities, we are stripping the life of the community. We are leaving a dead village when we strip the villages of their young people. Not only are we leaving them as a dead village without their young people, we're also taking the young people and we're separating them from their roots. From your roots as an Eskimo, as an Athabascan, comes your identity and your wisdom. Combined with the Western education, you can't be beat. That is why I felt rural education affairs, with its new directions, was a challenge. Every one of us have to sacrifice. You had to sacrifice. Think about it, what you had to sacrifice. Your responsibilities at home, your love for your mother, your father, your families. You sacrificed that to be here in a city to continue education. All of us have to sacrifice something. I sacrificed my family. I sacrificed my village. I had a responsibility at home as a Tlingit from Yakutat, but I felt that survival was through unity. Survival was through serving the whole state. I spent 18 years in the public health service. I started as a registered nurse a long time ago I graduated in 1948. I graduated from a hospital in Arizona as a registered nurse in 1951. And I became an Indian public health nurse on the Navajo Reservation, Papagoi Reservation, and so forth. And from there on, I came back up to Alaska, and I spent 18 years in that system, in the system of public health, in the area of nursing, from Bethel area, and I'm sure some of the kids that are from Bethel area are some kids that I delivered. From the Kuskokwim area to Barrow to then back to Mount Edgecombe. And when I was talking about tomorrow is upon us and your responsibility, I just shake at thinking about what your responsibilities are. Mistakes we make, there's no question about it. And I can only dedicate my life to continue to do my best, so that responsibility upon you won't be so heavy.
Think I'm coming down. You know I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think I'm coming down. Everything I had, took my good and made me bad. Then you taught me how to fly, but you let me fly too high. Now I think I'm coming down. Yes, I think
Lee Hazelwood, former president of AFN, Roger Lang, spoke about the implementation of the Land Claims Act and what some problems there are.
The problem is not with Native organizations or Native tasks and identification and selection of land. It's not in the Native handling of their business affairs, because that's going fairly well. The problem is that somebody forgot to tell the United States government that they have to survey 43.5 million acres of land and that they ought to gear up for it. Somebody forgot to tell the Bureau of Indian Affairs that this stops your authority over us and we've got things to do. Somebody forgot to tell the Alaska State Government that we don't have any lands yet and it's too early to be passing taxes on a prospective land that Alaska Natives will have or on their resources. With government, we're in trouble. They see us as vulnerable, and we probably are. They see us as susceptible to taxes, and we probably are. Because you see, when you study the history of America, at one time, American Indians owned land by acts of Congress, just like ours. And that keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. American Indians and Alaska Natives have been successful in getting lands. It's keeping it that gets us every time. And face it, this isn't a corporation act. This isn't a finance act. This is a land claims act. It's land. It's land that surrounds your villages. And that's what it's all about. It's a simple land transaction. We said to the federal government and we said to the state of Alaska, we'll define our lands so that your title is clear. And that's what this claims act is. And until we get those lands, it really is an exercise in futility. We are not of a nature that makes us corporate entities. I serve on boards of directors. I know what the rules are about being a corporate board of director, and I'm not comfortable with it. That's not what I am. Until we get the lands, I don't know what we're going to be. I have an idea. I wish I had a map that I could show you. Eventually, we'll own almost every deep water harbor in Alaska. We'll own 90% of the Kuskokwim, about 60% of the Yukon, almost all of the Noatak and Kobuk rivers. We're going to control access and egress, coming in and going out to a lot of things that happen in this state. And those that don't like us know that. You'll read that the Alaska Federation of Natives had a special meeting today. What are we going to do? We're going to take the Secretary of Interior to court again. We've had him in court 3 times since they passed the bill. We're going to take him to court again. The aim of the Alaska Federation of Natives is to deed to the natives of Alaska land as free from encumbrance as we can make it. That means easements, that means pipeline corridors, that means everything. We'll try to preserve for you good lands, lands that you can control yourself. And that's where the act is. But that isn't what's happening. Other things are happening because natives are organized. Because we have a little bit of money, some muscle, we certainly are getting a lot of political know-how. 10 years ago, we couldn't have said it. 5 years ago, we might have said, please help us do it. 1976, we'd do it ourselves. We don't need experts anymore. We've become sophisticated enough ourselves to suggest to the state and the federal government that we can make changes We've become sophisticated enough in our dealings with government, with people, with bureaucrats, that we can say, hey, your stuff don't work. And we've got other ideas. We've become good enough so that we can write legislation now. We can write laws. We used to ask people to do it for us. We used to write letters. We used to pass resolutions. We used to meet in conventions like this and ask people to do things for us. The legislature, lawyers, educators, bureaucrats. Now we can write laws. And that's a long way to come. It's a long way to come from just obeying laws so that we can write them. One time in 1966, I got a call from a guy named Emil Noddy and said, hey, Roger, what are you doing? I said, well, I got a good civil service job and I'm working toward retirement and, you know, I'm happy in Sitka. He says, hey, there's things to do. Things are happening. My message to you in 1976 is that there are things to do and things are happening like you never saw before. The potential, the possibility, the pride of being Alaska Native is probably the best thing that's happened in implementing the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. A good world for Alaska Native in 1976. Thank you.
Roger Lang. On our final segment, Claude Dominiff tells a story about a visitor to the native land and his encounters with some animals in the country.
Long, long time ago, when the north bank of the river flowed west and the south bank of the river flowed east, people didn't have to paddle upstream. They always went with the current. The animals could talk, and the man could talk to the animals. One of the first chiefs was named Chalkiyatsek. He was going through his country and his woods, and he saw this new person, a strange person, come walking through the woods, not really knowing where he was going, it seems like, because he didn't seem to have anything in mind. So Chalkiyatsek, he just kind of laid back and he's watching this person, this strange visitor to his land. And as this man walked down the animal path, two robins flew over him. And they started to circle above his head. And they said, hello, visitor, hello. You want to play a game? And the man said, well, I don't know what kind of game. So the bird said, just watch. So they took their eyes out and they threw them up in the air. They caught him and put him back in and said, see, that's a lot of fun. So the man said, okay, I'll try that. So he took his eyes out and he threw them up in the air and he caught them again and put them back in. He said, yeah, gee, that's a lot of fun. So they were having a good time taking their eyes out and throwing them up in the air and catching them and putting them back in. They were having a good time until one time when the visitor threw his eyes up in the air, the two robins came and they grabbed the eyes and flew around him laughing and laughing and laughing because they had tricked him. And then they flew away. And so the man didn't know what to do. Didn't know what to do. And he was lost. He couldn't see. He didn't know where he was. He didn't know what path he was on. He didn't really know where he was going. So he started to feel the path where they walked. And he went for a long, long, long ways, crawling, a couple days. Until he stopped and he rested and he leaned against a tree. He was going to rest. And as he was resting, something poking him in the eyes, you know, poking. So he waited till it poked and he reached out and he grabbed an arm. And it was the arm of a fox. And the fox had a little piece of grass and he was trying to find out what was wrong with this person. Just poking him. So the man, he said, now that I got you, you are going to be my eyes. And the fox said, I'll help you. I'll help you. You don't have to worry. If you can't see, I'll help you. But the man wouldn't trust the fox. Wouldn't trust the fox at all. So he made a collar out of some roots and made a leash for the collar. And he tied that to the fox, and they walked for several more days. And they talked, and they got to know each other. And as they rested on one of the third days, since in that time there was really no time, one of the third days, the fox decided that this person, this visitor, couldn't trust him enough, so he escaped. He slipped out of the collar, and he started running around this person, laughing, laughing, laughing again. He said, I tricked you, I tricked you. So the man, he tried to run after the fox. He tried to catch that fox, because he was mad. But the fox ran too fast, and the fox had eyes, so he could see. And in the man, while the man was running, he got lost his path. He didn't know, lost his path again. There he was, just running through the woods, running through the woods. Didn't know where he was going, till he bumped into a great big pine tree. And he stopped at the base of that pine tree, and the pitch was rolling onto the pine tree. And he took some pitch down off the tree like that. He rolled it up into a little ball, and he put it down. Took some more pitch, and he rolled it up into a little ball. Picked up both of those, and he breathed into them. Put him in, and he could see. Now the legend stops there to tell a moral, but the story goes on and on and on. They say that that is why the white man has blue eyes. But that tells us something. That tells us that we have a perception that there's something that is lost in that path. Economic and social interdependencies cause that person to be lost. So human resources is the process, in my opinion, of raising the potential of each and every one of us to help those who are lost. In that teaching, we can develop our potential. And because of developing that potential, we develop our human resource. And that's us.
I'm Mo Wasley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.